welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, and designers, those fantastic VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. Now, y'all know how much I love film and how much I like to talk about film and just talk in general. So it is an absolute joy every week to give you a front row seat to the who, what, where, when, why, and how of movie making with these interviews. Now, this week, we're turning our attention to the Miami art world. And first-time featured director Jing I Ng, with her film Forge. If I screwed up the pronunciation of your last name, Jing, I'm sorry, but I think I got it right. I thoroughly enjoyed this film from a story perspective and from a directorial and production perspective. As I've been seeing in quite a few films of late, and as you're hearing and reading in a lot of the interviews that I've been doing, quite a few films from these first-time feature directors. And once again, Jing falls into this category. Production values are high, but story and character are at the center of it all. They truly are at the forefront and are carrying and propelling these films of late. And I really love seeing that in this indie world of filmmaking. Now, on seeing Forge, I'll tell you up front, I would never believe that this was Jing's first feature directorial effort. And she's the screenwriter as well. So, what is Forge all about? Set in Miami, we meet the resourceful Zhang siblings, Raymond and his sister Coco, who sell forged paintings to unsuspecting parties. I know, it's starting off good already. Coco is an artist whose own work is so beautiful that it should be hanging in galleries, something that continues to frustrate her and her dream. Raymond, on the other hand, makes a buck providing fake IDs, licenses, passports, and other types of documents, including those that attest to the provenance of works of art. The Zhang family is unaware of what Coco and Raymond are doing, and they happily own and run a family Chinese restaurant, which by all accounts has quite tasty food based on the number of customers they always have. Despite their thriving underground operation, Coco and Raymond are still short on cash when they cross paths with disgraced millionaire Holden Beaumont. Sensing an opportunity to make a fortune, Holden convinces the Zhangs, more importantly, first Raymond, who has to convince Coco, to forge long-lost masterpieces as a front for his family's collection. Only as you'll see in the film, forging masterpieces are not quite that easy when there's a frame and no picture. But I digress. Meanwhile, FBI art crimes agent Emily Lee moves from New York to Miami, discovering a plethora of forgeries cropping up in the South Florida art market. As Emily continues to investigate, and she digs. Emily Lee digs, and she's beautifully played by Kelly Marie Tran. But as Emily continues to dig and investigate the Zhang siblings' work, everything, finally, in the third act, converges to a devastating effect in the Zhang family dim sum restaurant. So, as I mentioned, Forge is written and directed by Jing I Ng. It stars Kelly Marie Tran, Andy Ju as Coco, who just knocks it out of the park. You cannot look away from her when she is on screen. She has an intensity and a power that is fantastic. Brandon Suhu as Brother Raymond. Edmund Donovan, who is deliciously slick, as Holden Beaumont. Cinematographer, and I've got to give shout-outs to these artisans. cinematographer is Leo Perman, and his work is just astounding. And he's working in concert with production designer Ariel Nascone, who, I don't know how she's put these worlds together, because we have the Zhang restaurant, we have Coco's art studio in a warehouse, and we've got Holden's moneyed world that really doesn't have any money to it. Everything is beautifully edited by Brianna Schmielewski. And Brianna and Jing love montages. I'll tell you that right now. Love montages. Now, I love montages too. Sometimes they can be in excess and sometimes they can just suck. These are beautiful. They serve as exposition. And the overall pacing. We feel the tension. And a lot of the tension comes from how Brianna has put these montages together. As we see Coco and Raymond's world, especially Coco's world, juxtaposed against Agent Lee's world. It's really wonderful to see how she's put all this together in the editing process. And of course, composers Marco Carrion and Ian Chang. Just beautiful score here. With wonderful undercurrents of Asian instrumentation. So we always have that flavor in this Chinese community in Miami. Now, the first thing I took note of with Forge is that it is very montage heavy without droning on or being too much. Now, I'll tell you, my favorite montage sequencing uses dissolves and superimpositions as Coco ages canvas and paints while Raymond forges paperwork. Roughly at the hour 13-minute mark, there's a very tense montage that shows Coco painting masterpieces while Agent Lee is researching art crimes, while 2 minutes later, a quick follow-up montage shifts the film's entire tone. It is fantastic. And you sit there and you go, whoa. Now, one of the most interesting things about Forge is that the film focuses on the antagonists, Coco and Raymond and Holden, over the protagonist, a.k.a. poor Agent Lee, who seems to be operating all by herself in the FBI. But we get to know and understand each of them, especially Coco, who is a fascinating character, and, as I said, wonderfully portrayed by Andy Ju. At its core, this film really is a character study of Coco, in particular. She cherishes art, she appreciates it, and is a talented artist in her own right, who dreams of having a painting done by her hanging in a gallery, even if it's a forgery of someone else's work. That's how desperate she is to see her work hang in a gallery. Holden and Raymond, they're in this for money and greed. Bottom line. Now, all the puzzle pieces start solidifying about the hour 31 mark, about the 90-minute mark, thanks to Kelly Marie Tran's character, as Agent Lee. She connects all the dots within the Floridian Chinese community. The dots aren't just the players right here. There are more players involved. And, you know, in the third act, we see Coco's world crashing down. The lighter, dreamy score motifs we've heard throughout the film shift to heavy bass piano. It's a beautiful contrast that we see take shape with the visuals contrasting the darker, heavier music. Now, as you're going to hear, as Jing breaks it all down in this in-depth conversation, one of the things that stands out for me, and obviously her, is the origin story. She drew inspiration from the real-life, infamous Needler Gallery art forgery scandal in New York some years ago, particularly focusing on the mysterious Chinese forger who was never apprehended. Now, truth be told, he apparently fled to China, and since there's no extradition, he's kind of gone with the wind, not that anyone's ever found him there either. So no one has ever heard his side of the Needler story, which works to Jing's advantage as it gives her a blank canvas of creative freedom to craft a unique narrative centered on Coco and give her all the complexities possible, which also allows Jing to blur the line between antagonist and protagonist within Coco. It's really, as I said, this really is a great character study of Coco in many respects. Now, as you're going to hear Jing talk about, she emphasizes how the film invests the audiences emotionally in Coco and the Zhang family so that we care about her motivations and struggles, the family struggles, despite the criminal actions of Coco and Raymond. Now, the visual style is standout, and Jing works with cinematographer Leo Perman, and they develop a consistent color palette influenced by Florida's landscape artist. They collaborated with a local Miami painter to create original artworks for the film, ensuring authenticity for the region and a strong sense of place. Now, production designer Ariel Nascon then played a crucial role in distinguishing the film's various worlds, the opulence of Holden Beaumont, who is deliciously played by Edmond Donovan, I have to say, and his high-rise life, versus the warmth and intimacy of the Zhang family's Chinese restaurant and the shadowy, expansive warehouse where Coco works and where Raymond apparently has a little corner where he does his paperwork forgery. And amazingly, despite budget constraints for the film, the team's collaboration results in a film that appears far more expensive than its indie roots. And that's always a good thing, especially when you're talking about a moneyed art world. You want your film to look expensive. And this does. Jing also gets into the importance of editing and the montage, and she has amazing praise for her editor, Brianna, and Brianna's ability to use visual sequences to convey character development and shift the film's tone without relying on excessive dialogue. The score, composed by Marco Carrion and Ian Chang, weaves that Asian instrumentation with electronic elements, mirroring Coco's dreamy internal world and reinforcing her cultural identity while building the rest of the world around her. And Jing also recalled, as we were talking, and you'll hear this, and it's really, it's a lovely anecdote. She wrote the script while listening to Ian Chang's solo album, which heavily influenced the film's musical direction. Now, surprisingly, casting was the really big challenge here, as the production had no leads attached at the outset. Yeah, no one. The casting process did involve extensive auditions, and it ultimately resulted in a strong ensemble, including Andy Jew, Kelly Marie Tran, and a little surprise for me that just tickled me and was reinforced. My joy over seeing this actor was reinforced this weekend as there was a Lethal Weapon marathon on some channel on TV. And as I was flipping channels, it's like, ah, Mel, gotta stop and see that. So watched all four after four times of watching the new Dutton Ranch series, the first two episodes. I'll talk about that at the end of the show. But Raymond Ma, who is the dentist in the Uncle Benny scene in Lethal Weapon 4. And I'm sure you all remember that scene, the laughing gas with Uncle Benny. But Raymond Ma is the dentist, and Raymond Ma is here as Coco and Raymond's uncle in the restaurant. Now, you've got great nuanced performances from Edmond Donovan and Eva DiDomenici, who plays Holden's wife, Talia. They avoided caricature, and they brought depth to their roles. And these could have been just superficial nothings. But something that is particularly notable And I hope when you guys see the film, and really, you do need to go see the film, special attention was given to realistic details, rooting this in realism. And one of those elements of realism is Kelly Marie Tran's costume as an FBI agent. It reflects the practical working class reality of an actual agent rather than Hollywood stereotypes such as Sandra Bullock as everyone's favorite female FBI agent, Gracie Hart, who had a very bespoke and tailored looking to her. Kelly Marie Tran's agent, Lee, looked like she went to Walmart and pulled a blue polyester blazer, blue pants, and a white shirt off the rack. No dis intended, because agents low on the totem pole don't get paid that much. So maybe Walmart is all they can afford. But, you know, and something that I really love in talking to Jing, you can tell I really liked speaking with Jing about this film. As she reflects on this process for bringing Forge to life, is her growth as a director and a storyteller. And something that she's learned is emphasizing the importance of focusing on the main character and compound that with the collaborative nature of filmmaking. I love this interview. I love Jing. She's wonderful to speak with, and you're going to hear that right now. But she has a wonderful directorial and storytelling eye, and I can't wait to see what else she gives us. But for right now, she's given us Forge. So take a listen as writer-director Jing I-ing talks all things Forge. Hi, Jing.
Hi, Debbie.
Well, I have to say, the whole idea of this film excited me. I love films like this, especially when they're inspired on true crime, which yours most definitely is. That whole Needler scandal in New York a number of years ago, I got a kick out of that since Jackson Pollock was one of the artists forged. And it's like a kindergarten, you think a kindergarten kid could forge a Jackson Pollock with paint splatter. But what you do, you keep us focused in the Miami art crowd, where there's money to spend on art, with Palm Beach and whatnot, not too far from Miami. But you really invest us in our antagonist. You invest us in Coco and Raymond, particularly Coco. It's not too often where we really care about the villain in a situation like this. And that I found so striking. And you knocked it out of the park in casting Andy Ju as Coco. She really has an intensity to her. When you watch her, and when she's spinning stories to Kelly Marie Tran's FBI agent, Emily Lee, you really believe her. You believe her, which just invests you more in her and her family and the tale of the uncle and how he was stripped naked and left, but for his underwear and left in the street. You believe everything that comes out of her mouth. And if we didn't believe that, this film wouldn't work. It would be a kind of a run-of-the-mill art forgery film, heist film. But because of that, we are so invested in Coco and her belief in art and her love of art that we are there for the ride to the very end. And without giving away spoilers, at the very end of the movie, you're kind of grinning and going, all right, Coco. So how did you get inspired by the Needler Gallery scandal and others that led you to tell this very focused story?
Yeah, I'm so happy that you referenced that particular scandal because the forger behind those tens of millions of dollars of art was Chinese. And that really was a huge inspiration for the story because the forger fled and was never interviewed. Complete question mark. And so that is a great canvas and a great starting point for any storyteller, right? Especially someone like me who loves art forgery and art crime and wants to talk about identity in movies. Yeah, that was a great jumping point.
And of course, because the forger himself has never been found, of course, last I heard, he's somewhere in China, and we have no extradition, so even if he would get caught, nothing, he's not coming to the States for anything. But because we've never heard his story, you weren't bound by anything.
So yeah, precisely.
You had free reign, and that is a gift that not too many filmmakers and screenwriters get.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, with especially with Forge, like, sometimes people are like, oh, that's just unbelievable. But the truth is, like, we really don't know. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of art forgers have crazier stories than what I'm portraying. But this is just really what my imagination came up with.
Well, your imagination works really well, Jing.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's an excellent imagination. So with a blank canvas, but for the idea of an art forgery, the rich in Miami Beach, selling paintings, you take this into incredible directions such as Holden Beaumont, who truly is the most despicable character in the entire film. He really is. So how did you then craft this story and do so so that it would translate cinematically?
Yes. I think so, like, in a lot of ways, like, art forgery lends itself to being in a film because it's such a visual crime, right? It's really about, like, the deception of what you can see and what you can tell and what you feel when you look at an art piece. So that itself, like, really lended itself to making a movie about. And obviously me and my CP, Leo Perman, we had really strong visual references. And also we wanted to reference, like, other great crime and forgery movies. A good example is probably To Live and Die in L.A., which is a forgery movie that we referenced directly in our forgery sequence. So taking inspiration from that, but also making sure that, like, you know, this is slightly different so that we lended a softer touch to the main character. Like you said, she's a villain, but we still wanted you to feel for her.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, and your visual references, I love the paintings that you have because you keep a pretty even color palette throughout the film. But for, you know, the initial scenes between Coco selling a painting to Sandy Baker, that painting is beautiful with the pinks and whatnot. You reserve those pops of color for the paintings within the film itself. And I found that to be very visually striking. And because it is so different than the overall palette of the film, that really stands out and it catches your eye and draws you in to that particular, especially at the opening story, to that particular story that set the groundwork for the whole film. So as you worked with Leo to come up with your color palette and your visual grammar, were there any paintings you were particularly influenced by to kind of capture visually in the film?
Yeah, definitely. We reference a lot of Florida landscape artists. And so we did a lot of extensive research on, like, the kinds of paintings and the art movements that came out of South Florida. And we actually, for our John Redfar, hired a local Miami painter that did all the work for the movie. And so it was very much a collaboration between him, our production designer, Ariel, and the art team, and as well as Leo and me. So it really was like a meeting of minds and figuring out how to bring this influence of South Florida landscapes into our movie. prominently.
Some of those paintings that you have are gorgeous. And I was enamored with the fact that we have Holden saying, well, here's my grandfather's paintings, and there's nothing there. It's one thing to have a hurricane strike and have water damage. It's another thing to have the canvases eaten away, holes in the middle, and you have a frame, and you have to try and figure out what goes in it. And I just thought that was a very cool thing, because that really gave you carte blanche. Total carte blanche. For whatever imagery you wanted to have on canvas. And the ones you came up with, I love the vertical, I think it was a calla lily with the white, the beautiful white, which I think is the only time we see anything with any real white within the film and the paintings. So you have these very striking moments. And I'm glad you mentioned Ariel, your production designer, Ariel Nescon. You two do a beautiful job showing us the two worlds, showing us Holden's world of mansions and money and, you know, his 50th floor, all glass office looking out over the world, and he's nothing but a con artist and a thief himself, and really looked a gift horse in the mouth coming out of money. And you contrast that with the warmth of the Zhang family Chinese restaurant. And then you counter it with Coco's warehouse studio that actually, as large as the studio is with the higher ceilings, and you get the impression, and your camera angles there are very important, because to establish that size, Leo has the camera up higher looking down. So we get that POV that's Dutched, actually. But Ariel does a beautiful job. We get the reds and the warmth of the family Chinese restaurant. We get the closeness, the shadows, the negative space in Coco's work area, the warehouse. And then we get just the greed and haughtiness of Holden and his world. How much free rein did you give Ariel in her production design? Because these are very distinct worlds that you create.
Yeah, well, we were all limited by the fact that, you know, this is a indie budget that we're working with. And I wrote an art forgery film, which is, you know, ambitious on a budget like this, to say the least. And so definitely we were all already limited by the fact that we had to work with what we had access to, what was in our budget, what locations we could get for free, for example. And because of that, like, it became a true collaboration between all the heads of departments to kind of put our heads together and see, okay, like, this is tropical Chinese and we are filming here. How do we, you know, complement our story and make adjustments in the environment so that we can tell the story that we want to tell? And yeah, definitely, you know, compromises were certainly made in the script levels in order to accommodate the budget. But I think without Ariel, without Leo and our amazing art team and everyone on the film, really, like, we wouldn't have been able to bring it to life with such detail, to attention. And so really it was a conversation we were constantly having about color palette, like, how do we want this environment to feel versus that? And I think in a lot of ways, I'm really proud, because I think the film looks way more expensive than it actually was. And so, yeah, it's a testament to everyone putting their heads together.
Well, the film does look expensive, I'll tell you that, Jing. And one of the ways that actual increases the visual value are Leo's shots, his lighting, his lensing, but also Brianna's editing. You have quite a few montages in here. Granted, some of them are only like 90 seconds, but they're beautiful, you know, starting like around the 57-minute mark. As we're learning more about Coco and Raymond, you know, we see Coco's aging and painting process in this montage set against Raymond and how he forges paperwork, driver's licenses, passports, and everything else to develop provenance on all of these paintings. But then probably 5-10 minutes later, you start with some really pretty montages that shift the tone of the film.
Yes.
So, number one, you're saving on exposition, but number two, those montages are done so beautifully, especially there. You got one at the 113 mark where Coco's painting, but Agent Lee is researching art crimes. And Brianna's editing is so seamless, going back and forth between the two. And everything is coming together at that point. So you really use your montages for a tonal shift here at that roughly hour mark. And they're just so beautiful to look at. And everything is so compact. We don't need Coco yelling at her brother. We don't need Holden yelling at everybody, "I need money, hurry up, hurry up." It's just visually beautiful, and that ups your value right away. So good on you with that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, Leo and Bree, Brianna, I've been working with for almost a decade. We met in film school like 9 years ago, so it's so wonderful to hear you praise them, and I'm very proud.
You should be. Now, your music is not to be overlooked in this film. You've got your two composers, Marco Carrion, Ian Chang. And I have to say, very interesting musical motifs. So I'm curious what you were looking for musically. One thing I noticed, when Coco is in her art mode, when she's happy, when she's smiling, when she's talking about art, when she's painting, the music has a dreamy quality to it. And behind a lot of the music, there's always a touch of Asian instrumentation. So we get the cultural influence in here as well. So I'm curious what you were looking for from Marco and Ian musically.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote the script, The Forge, to Ian Chang's solo album. And it was something that informed my writing very strongly. I love that he uses Asian instrumentation. He's a really, really wonderful percussionist, obviously. He scored films with his band Sun Lux before, like probably most notably Everything Everywhere All at Once. But this was like his first solo score, and Marco joined him for that. And it was just a wonderful collaboration because I really saw this movie as a movie with an electronic score, which I love. And it has those traits, like you mentioned, of those, that Asian instrumentation that kind of brings that unique quality. And I do think that Coco is a character that very much so lives in her head and in her dreams.
Yeah.
And that fantasy, you know, sometimes gets in the way of real life and what the audience would consider important, like family and all this. But to Coco, like, maybe that's secondary, and that's a painful reality. But it's also, we wanted the audience to feel what she felt at the same time. And I think the music is an important part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I love the score. And the way it is so intertwined with Coco, which really is another reason that really helps us like this antagonist so much, because in so many respects, she's not an antagonist. Although she's committing a really massive crime that could land her in a federal penitentiary for, I don't know, 30, 40 years, if not more.
Yeah.
That aspect of this whole film and the possibility, it kept me thinking back to the Thomas Crown Affair, be it the Steve McQueen version or the Pierce Brosnan version, which was all about stealing the masters and creating or copying the masters from prison. No less for Thomas Crown's father.
Yeah.
So I love that, you know, those cinematic tie-ins. Now, how difficult was your casting here? Because you scored big with Andy. Kelly Marie Tran is always wonderful. I was tickled to see Raymond Ma pop up. He is most known for being the dentist in Lethal Weapon 4, giving laughing gas to Uncle Benny. Talk to me about your casting here.
Yeah, we felt really strongly that for the two leads, We would have a discovery casting process, and the really unique thing about this film is that we did not have a cast attached by the time we knew that the film was going to film, and we were going to production, so we were able to open it up, really, and T.R. Knight was the first person who came on board. He pitched himself as Sandy Baker, which is not something we initially pictured, but it, as you can see, like, it's so wonderful.
Yeah.
And then Kelly came on board, and then we spent, you know, a few months auditioning people all across the country for the roles of Coco and Ray. And we're so happy that we found Andy and Brandon. That was something that took a lot of time and effort, and it was so awesome.
And, of course, how difficult was it to cast Holden and his wife, Talia? You ended up with Edmund Donovan and Eva DiDomenici, and they're brilliant. They're wonderful.
Yes.
Edmund especially, he's like an oil, he's like a used car salesman with an oil slick on him.
Definitely. I think, like, with Eva and Edmund, it was so great to have found him, because it was actually a really difficult, those two roles were actually very difficult to cast, because if you cast them, you know, in a different way, it's possible they come across as caricatures of what they are.
Yeah.
And I really think those two brought so much depth and humanity to what those characters are. Like, you still feel so sorry for Holden, even though he represents so much that is wrong. And I do think that, like, the chemistry they had with our leads was really important.
Your chemistry amongst basically the four, Coco, Raymond, Talia, Holden, is really well done. And you, because you don't want Kelly's to have chemistry with all of them, just a little bit, but because she's on the outside looking in, and once she figures out what's going on, she really has to up her game and really wear that FBI badge. And which, by the way, I have to compliment your costumer on Kelly's poor person FBI outfit. It's not the nicely tailored Sandra Bullock FBI uniform that we're used to seeing. This is, I gotta have a dark jacket. I gotta have pants. I have to have really comfortable shoes. I've gotta have a white shirt. But they don't pay me enough this far down on the totem pole to go get it custom fitted and designed. So this was a working class FBI agent.
Yep. And I think it reflects the reality of, like, you know, the actual FBI, especially the art crimes department, which is something we research really extensively. And yeah, our costumer, Colleen, she did such a great job with the budget we had, not just with Kelly, but with everyone. But I think, you know, Kelly is an actor who really cares about her costumes.
Yeah.
And it was a joy to get to see, like, when the final fitting happened and it all came together.
Yeah, that really impressed me. Growing up, we had an FBI agent who lived two doors away from us. In our neighborhood. And they had five or six kids living in a four-bedroom, two-story colonial house and drove a station wagon. He drove a station wagon to and from his office. Never fancy. With all those kids, he wasn't making that much money. I mean, he was clean and presentable, but nothing ever yelled bespoke as FBI agent like a Sandra Bullock character.
Yes, exactly. The reality is very different.
Reality is very different. And I really appreciated that you did that.
Thank you so much. Yeah, that was something we really wanted to come across.
So now I know they're going to get nasty here because we have to end. And you have to move on. But before I let you go, Jing, I've got to know, your first feature film, what did you learn about yourself as a director, as a storyteller, that you can take forward into your future projects?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, a feature is definitely a marathon. There's so much more to it than just production and development. The post-process alone is completely different from anything I've ever done before. And that's something I'm definitely going to take forward technically. But as a storyteller, I learned that, you know, you have to pay, like, close attention to your main character, even more than you think. Like, be paranoid about it, if anything. And then also, I learned that I really love directing, and it's something that I'm going to commit the rest of my life to if I can and I have the privilege to. I really believe in movies and the stories that people tell. So I'm really passionate about carrying this through.
You've done a great job here, Jing, and I can't wait to see what you bring us next.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank you, and I hope we get to chat again in the future.
Yes, absolutely. This was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you so much, Jing. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. And that was writer-director Jing I-ing talking about Forge. Now, before we go today, I must mention The Mandalorian and Grogu is out on the 22nd. You must go to the theater and see The Mandalorian and Grogu. I know I will be there at some point over the weekend to see it. But also, Dutton Ranch. All right, people. I don't know. Some of you may have been sick of hearing about Yellowstone every week while it was still on. I'm a diehard Yellowstone fan. I do really like Marshalls, which is the further adventures of Casey Dutton, wonderfully played by Luke Grimes. More importantly, with Marshalls, I love that Gil Birmingham returns as chairman, Thomas Rainwater, the chairman of the Broken Rock Reservation, and his right hand, Mo Brings Plenty. I love the character of Mo. Of course, Mo lives and breathes his heritage every day. So this is no performance from Mo. But I really like Marshalls. I like the procedural aspect of it. And we see Casey still holding on to part of, he can't change who he is. But to see him stepping into an arena as a U.S. Marshal, something he knows from being a SEAL, it's interesting. And I like the procedural aspect. And of course, next week is the season one finale of Marshalls. Just so you all know, on Sunday nights at 8 o'clock, in whatever your respective time zone is. So it looks like it's going to be a good one. And it looks like Chairman Rainwater's vehicle gets hit with gunfire. Is he in it? Is Mo in it? Do we lose somebody that we love? I'm chomping at the bit for that. But in the meantime, two nights ago, Friday night, it finally premiered Dutton Ranch with Cole Hauser and Kelly Riley and Finn Little. Oh my. If you follow me on social media, you've seen many of my posts already about Dutton Ranch. Yes, we were treated to two episodes back to back to kick off the series and season one. And I hope to God that we're going to get an announcement soon that there's already going to be a season two. We start out the series in Montana, and it's beautiful. And Christina Voros is cinematographer and director. She directed and was lensing, I think, the last full year, for the most part, of Yellowstone. So we open the first 15 minutes of the film. We're in Montana. And Beth and Rip, they've got their own ranch over in Madison that they bought at the end of Yellowstone when Casey sold the Yellowstone to Broken Rock and just kept the East Camp for himself. At the end of season three, we saw the coordinated attack on the Duttons in Yellowstone. Season four kicked off with the continuance of that coordinated attack on the Duttons, and also the chase. Once Rip found John Dutton bleeding out on the road, but John had used his blood and his finger to indicate which direction the van went and what the van looked like. The best 17 minutes in television. The best opening 17 minutes in television, and I maintain that. But now, it's got a rival. Because the first 15 minutes of Dutton Ranch rivals the excitement and the energy and the power of that 17 minutes from that kicked off season 4 of Yellowstone. With a catastrophe, thanks to Mother Nature and Rip and Beth, because of what happens, sends them on their way to Texas. They leave Montana to start again. And that's how they get to Texas. And if you haven't seen it, watch it. It's on Paramount Plus. If you have seen it, for those of you that don't know, that fire sequence, Cole Hauser did that fire sequence himself. He rode through fires, saving a little calf, a baby cow, a little calf. That was Cole riding through fires, jumping with the horse. Just amazing. There's no word to describe watching it. So Dutton Ranch, this is the season 5 we really wanted for Yellowstone. Had Kevin Costner not left, which changed Taylor Sheridan's plans for giving us 7 seasons of Yellowstone. So we got 5 to explain what happened to John Dutton. But this is phenomenal. Beth and Rip are back better than ever. I love seeing Finn Little. He's now 19 years old. He is 19. He's 19 now in the show. So watching him navigate girls in a new town at a new high school, that adds its own wrinkles. Annette Bening is amazing. And Ed Harris, oh my God, as the veterinarian, Everett McKinney, I'm in love with this character, and I cannot wait to see where the character of Everett goes. I am just so excited over Dutton Ranch. So, you know, I did watch 8 hours of it, both episodes 4 times each. 3 on Paramount Plus, and Friday night at 8 o'clock, it aired on Paramount Network. On television, so I watched it there as well. So there, I have done my joyous recap of Dutton Ranch and my enthusiastic endorsement. So if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor. Do yourself a favor. But that is all the time we have today. Make sure to check out Forge this week and next. It's currently it opened on Friday at the Landmark New Art in Los Angeles. And it opens this Friday, the 22nd, at the Quad Cinema in New York, and then goes on a wider rollout thereafter. Now, because of the Memorial Day holiday next weekend, and because I may just be heading out for my 50th high school reunion next weekend, I won't have a new show for you next Monday on Memorial Day. But keep checking the website, behindthelensonline.net, as new stuff is going up all this week. There's a bunch of new stuff up now, including trailers. I even threw some of those up because some came out I actually liked. You know, including another shark movie that's coming called Chum. And so new stuff is going up on the website. And then starting next week, all of those FYC Emmy interviews with artisans that I've been doing, they'll start popping up as we count down to June 11th, which is when voting for Emmy nominations begins. So didn't want to get those interviews up too soon. I want them fresh in everybody's mind as they start getting the reminders to do their voting for Emmy nominations. And Dances with Films is just around the corner. And come June 1st, you'll start seeing and hearing interviews on some of those films. I've already got, I think, 6 films that publicists have hit me up about watching for Dances with Films and doing interviews on. And Dances with Films starts on the 18th of June. So there's a lot of stuff coming up over the next few weeks. A lot of stuff I've got on the calendar already. And a lot of stuff I'll be talking about with you here on Behind the Lens on BTL Radio Show. And then even more that'll be popping up on the website. And one that I can't wait. I cannot wait. I've got 2 that I cannot wait for embargoes to lift. One is The Breadwinner. Great family comedy. It's opening on the 29th. It's embargoed right now, but that's all I can say other than you will love it. Take the whole family. And Hungry, which is opening on June 3rd. You talk about hungry, hungry hippos? These are beyond hungry, hungry hippos. And it's directed by James Nunn, who I just love. And you've heard James and I talk about many other films, many different kinds of films. Sharkbait being one of them. One Shot, One More Shot with Scott Adkins and some others. But hippos? Trust me. Trust me on this. So hopefully, and everything on hippos, including my interview with James, is embargoed until opening day. So I think June 8th, you're going to hear my interview with James Nunn talking about Hungry and hippos. So there's a lot of giddy stuff coming, folks. So have a wonderful holiday weekend. Stay safe. Remember our veterans, remember the sacrifices that our men and women in arms have given for our freedoms, for this country, and of course, may the force of Grogu be with you. I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.